Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truths listeners. Get ready for a crashing conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Crashing, as in traffic collision and crashes. The National Highway and Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, estimated that 42,795 people died in motor vehicle traffic crashes in 2022. Those are all preventable deaths. Of those, 13,524 were alcohol-related, which is 31.6% of all crashes. Well, what about drug driving? Well, we don't have such data for various drugs such as marijuana, methamphetamine, or prescriptions. But what we can say is that 56% of drivers involved in serious injury and fatal crashes tested positive for at least one drug. The U.S. Department of Transportation has a strategy to decrease deaths. This includes safer people, safer roads, safer vehicles, safer speeds, and post-crash care. Well, we've done a remarkable job in our country for safer roads and vehicles. And as an emergency physician, I can attest that we do a pretty good job in post-crash medical care. But how are we doing with safer people? Do we have more or less drunk drivers, drug drivers, distracted drivers, or drowsy drivers? You should never get in a car with a driver or as a passenger with somebody who is driving impaired. Impaired from alcohol, pot, illegal drugs, prescriptions, or any condition. What does impairment look like? Well, we're all familiar with the drunk driving test of walking in a straight line or tracking your finger to your nose. But that's for alcohol impairment. Marijuana impairment looks different. The impaired person may be able to walk in a straight line, but they cannot follow or remember simple directions. To learn more about crashes, I reached out to Ari Briskman. Sergeant Ari Briskman served as a law enforcement officer since 2007 in Illinois. He serves as the Technical Crash Investigation Team Commander, Auxiliary Deputy Unit Commander, and as a Public Information Officer. Ari has dedicated much of his career to impaired driving enforcement and traffic safety. He's a certified drug recognition expert and instructor. He's been recognized several times by the Alliance Against Intoxicated Motorists and Mothers Against Drunk Driving. To learn more about Ari Briskman, check out the High Truths show notes. Sergeant Ari Briskman, welcome to High Truths.
Dr. Lev, thank you.
Ari, that's a great name, first of all. It's my nephew's name, so I love it. So we're going to be off to a great start. And shout out to Jennifer Cifaldi, who put us together. She said that she works with you, and we're supposed to do a presentation together next year.
Yes, looking forward to it.
Yeah, so that'll be nice. And, nice Jewish boy, parents want you to grow up and be a doctor or a lawyer. These days, it's not even that. It's to be a startup company, but you chose to be a law enforcement officer. Tell us about that.
So I can remember the day pretty vividly, actually. I think I was 6 or 7 years old in elementary school, and we had an officer friendly come to visit the classroom and to talk about the police and what they did. And I had never had much contact with law enforcement prior to that. I have no law enforcement in my family. And I remember that day being absolutely enthralled by that officer. And I was so impressed with how put together and professional he looked. And I looked at him the way people look at a superhero. He was a superhero to me. And I said, I can remember in my head thinking, that's what I want to be. That's what I want to be when I get older. And That's what I told my parents that day when I came home. And of course, like all parents, they say, well, you'll change your mind 12, 1400 times. And I never did. I never changed my mind. I went and became a law enforcement explorer when I was 14, which is essentially a Boy Scout with the police, where you learn about law enforcement and all the different facets of the career. And I went to college, got a degree in law enforcement, which is essentially criminal justice. And I think once I started majoring in that, my parents knew this is it. He's not turning back from this choice. They still held out a little hope, maybe a lawyer. I might go that route, but I never swayed in my own mind. And when I was 21 years old, I was hired as a police officer. I completed the academy at 22, and I've been doing it ever since. And I love it every day. I never regret for one second taking on this career.
That's awesome. It's great when you love what you do, and you are a superhero.
Thank you.
And your specialty is in traffic collisions. So how did that come about?
So a little bit by accident, actually, so to speak, which, by the way, I always...
Oh, pun intended, right? By accident.
Pun intended. They're always crashes. They're never accidents. Collision's also a great word, and I'll touch on why in a little bit. But early in my career, I found that one of the ways that, as a police officer, I could make the most difference was by removing an impaired driver from the road. We might deal with the same family over and over again in a domestic violence situation, or the same drug user, or the same person with mental illness over and over again. And it didn't seem to me that I was making much of a difference doing that. We just seemed to be running on a hamster wheel, so to speak, and not going anywhere. But by taking that impaired driver off the road, I realized I was potentially saving a life, their own, someone else's that night. And it really hit home for me when I started actually seeing crashes involving these impaired drivers, where they were injuring people and killing them. So initially, I focused pretty heavily on impaired driving enforcement. That was my niche. And I decided after that to then start to maybe figure out how some of these crashes were also occurring, and to put the pieces of the puzzle back together, to bring closure to the victims, to provide some semblance of justice as I could. And that's how I got into traffic crash investigation. And from there, it led to reconstruction, and I went to a lot of the classes, and I found I really enjoyed it. It's to me, one of the most rewarding things I've done in this career, both the impaired driving side of it and the traffic crash investigation side.
Oh, interesting. So you are a DRE, and tell us what is that? What does that mean?
Sure. So DRE stands for Drug Recognition Expert. And this is a term that was coined several decades ago. The Los Angeles Police Department was the one that put this program together back in the late 70s, early 80s. They started seeing people who were under the influence of certain drugs displayed similar signs and symptoms. And they grouped the drugs into various categories, and they had officers post-arrest evaluating these people, doing things like different field sobriety tests, or taking their pulse, or measuring their pupil size. And this program, they found, was extraordinarily successful in prosecuting these drivers, because prior to that, they would have to have a doctor come in to testify in court about this person's impairment. And being a doctor, I'm sure you're incredibly busy, and trying to get a doctor to testify is difficult. So once they had this training, they found it was a great success. And the program wasn't just developed by the police, but they had input from medical personnel and scientists and toxicologists and a whole wide array of folks that developed this. And then eventually, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, looked at this program with the LAPD and said, this is something we want to explore a little bit more. And they conducted a study and found that it works and it's effective. And so they brought it out nationally. And today, it's not just a national program, it's an international program that is administered through both NHTSA and the International Association of Chiefs of Police. It is in the United States, it's in Canada, it's in several European countries. All of these officers, like me, have received the same basic level of training for drug recognition expert, where we are trained to conduct an evaluation on a subject, generally post-arrest, and to make some determinations. One, is that person impaired? Two, if that person is impaired, is it alcohol, drugs, or medical impairment? And if it's some type of drug, what category or categories of drugs are causing that impairment? And ultimately, we can provide an expert opinion in court as to which of those categories are causing the person's impairment. This is not something that is an easy certification to receive. It's quite a bit of training. It's almost 2 weeks in a classroom, followed by multiple field certifications where we have to evaluate actual impaired people under the tutelage of a DRE instructor, which I also am at this point. And it's a very difficult certification to get in that regard. And then to maintain, you have to keep it up by doing these evaluations, by continuing your education and your knowledge. So unfortunately, a lot of law enforcement training is check the box and attend the class and you get the credit. And that's not so for DRE. It is something that you have to work at and work at to maintain. And it's a certification I'm very proud to have.
That's great. And so how common it is, you said that it's now international, but there are impaired drivers in, you know, all 50 states. How common is it? Do every state have people like you available? I'm sure not, like you said, not every officer has this skill. They could do the alcohol test, but impairment is different for alcohol and various other drugs. So that's what the whole DRE specialty is able to detect. They detect impairment, not just alcohol impairment, which is just one. So how does every state have them? Is it rare? Do we need more?
Well, we can always use more. That is the absolute truth. We can always use more. Because of the level of training that it requires, it is not very common. So in Illinois, where I'm based, for example, there's approximately 120 to 130 DREs in Illinois, active certified DREs. And you're talking about a law enforcement population of over 20,000, 20, 30,000 police officers in Illinois. So it's a very small percentage of the law enforcement population in Illinois. Some states have more, which is similar to what their population size would be. So for example, California has hundreds of them, but they also have thousands more police officers than Illinois, and some have less than Illinois. Most law enforcement agencies do not even have one DRE. I will say that most do not even have one. There are some that are blessed to have a few or even two, but it's not a common certification to obtain. And we find that roughly, in my experience, almost half of the officers who go through the training don't maintain it. After the 2 years comes, which is our recertification period, they decide that they don't want to recertify, that it's too much for them. So they drop from the program. And that's unfortunate, but that's to me, that's okay. I would rather have people that are dedicated, willing to put the time in and make the effort than people that just want to have that certification or that label on their resume. But as I said, we can always use more. We hold at least two classes a year here in Illinois. Some states have more. It is not a class that you can just sign up for. You have to be recommended both by your agency and by a local prosecuting authority to be able to attend. So when I first attended almost 10 years ago, my state's attorney's office had to write a letter of recommendation for me to go, attesting that I was excellent at DUI enforcement, that I wrote good reports, that I testified well. And that's not something that a lot of prosecutors are willing to do for officers. So again, it adds to the rarity of the certification.
Right. I see what you're saying, that having a certification, it's not just doing the evaluation. It's also able to go to court and testify and make the case, which is a different skill set too.
That is the hardest skill set in the DRE world, is being able to explain and articulate the impairment, because I could teach anybody to conduct the 12-step DRE evaluation. That's not the difficult part. But being able to explain why that what I'm seeing is impairment and explain it in a language that a judge or a jury could understand, that is a very difficult skill to learn. It's not something that some people ever learn or want to learn, but it's absolutely a necessity for DREs.
And that could be intimidating too.
Absolutely.
So, all right, the evaluation, let's talk about that. Someone's pulled over for whatever suspicion and like, I'm fine, officer, but now what do? Get out of the car.
Yes. So the DUI investigations, they can take multiple different paths, but we'll take a very basic path from a traffic stop a violation's observed and the officer sees indicators of impairment, whether it's the person's speech, their eyes, a type of odor, movement, something that gives them pause to say there's something wrong with this person. Their training would dictate that every officer, at least in Illinois and most states, that they're going to ask that driver to step out and perform field sobriety tests. Most officers throughout the United States are all trained in the NHTSA standardized field sobriety tests, horizontal gaze nystagmus, walk and turn, and one leg stand.
So wait, say that again, the three steps that you said, that's just for alcohol impairment. So say that again. So
they're not just for alcohol. They can be used to detect impairment from other drugs. They have not been validated for drugs other than alcohol. So each of those tests has clues that are associated. A number of clues is associated, has a statistical correlation to impairment from alcohol at 0.08 or higher. So without getting too much into the weeds on that, they administer those tests and they decide, yes, this person is impaired.
Right. But those are the tests that everybody knows about. Like, right? Anybody's watched any television, seen people, okay, walk in a straight line, you know, track your eyes, and either you could do that or you can't.
Exactly. And from those tests and the officer's at scene investigation with that person, they are then making the determination that that person is impaired. Generally, one of the last steps that they will do at the roadside is ask that person to provide a breath sample. And if that person's breath sample is very low or even all zeros, that's telling that officer that, yes, this person is impaired, but it's probably not alcohol that's causing the impairment. So at that point, the officer ideally would arrest that subject for DUI drugs based on their observations. And then that person would be brought to a jail or a police station, and a DRE would be called at that point to conduct a post-arrest drug influence evaluation to make that determination of, is that person actually impaired? Is it some type of drug? Is it a medical condition? And if it's a drug, what type of drug is causing the impairment?
All right. So take us through the next step, the broader evaluation. Like, I've seen some of them where they ask you to, you know, a three step command, which is, and people who are impaired can't like remember. They could walk a straight line, but they can't remember to turn my right hand or my left hand which way. Or
sure. So the evaluation always starts off with some type of breath test, whether the officer was administering it themselves, whether the DRE administers it. If that person is providing a breath test of 0.08 or higher, which is the per se illegal alcohol limit in every state in the country, except for Utah, which is now 0.05, they will say, okay, it is not alcohol causing the impairment. The next thing that the DRE is going to do is they will interview the arresting officer. So they'll say, they'll ask the officer, what did you see? What did you hear? What did you smell? How did the person perform on the field sobriety test that you administered? We want to get as much background information from that arresting officer as we can, because sometimes what the officer sees at roadside is different from what we will see during the drug influence evaluation. And that can affect our opinion as to which category is causing that impairment, because some drugs will change how that person is acting over a period of time. So that interview is crucial. Following the interview, we are going to conduct a preliminary exam of that person. We're going to check their eyes briefly to make sure there's no signs of head injury. We will take a pulse from them at that point. We'll ask them some preliminary medical questions. We'll then go through a series of eye examinations, thorough eye examinations, including the horizontal gaze nystagmus, which is that test where we're seeing if your eyes jerk as they move from side to side. We'll check for something called lack of convergence, which is, do the eyes cross or can they cross when you bring a stimulus towards the bridge of their nose? Following that, we're going to conduct a series of divided attention tests, which are some of the same tests that you've seen at roadside: walk and turn, one leg stand, finger to nose, modified Romberg balance test, where they have to tilt their head back and close their eyes for what they think is 30 seconds. All of these are giving us good indicators of physical and mental impairment as well. Following the divided attention tests, we're going to then conduct a series of other examinations. So we're going to check pupil sizes and different lighting conditions. We are going to actually take blood pressure. We are going to take their body temperature using an oral thermometer. All of this is going to be done over a series of 12 steps. It's all going to be done in a methodical order. We are going to be asking them questions throughout this. So it's not just I'm administering this test, then I move on to this test, then I move on to this test. It all encompasses an interview actually while we're doing it. We're talking to this person to gauge their impairment. So by the end of it, we have potentially identified hundreds of different indicators of impairment at the end of the evaluation. There are some evaluations that I've conducted that have taken me over 2 hours to administer because one, perhaps the person cannot perform these tests well enough that they are alert, that I have to keep repeating instructions. Perhaps I ask a lot of questions because I really want to get great information from them and I'm really trying to figure out exactly what's going on. Some of them are a little quicker than that. It varies on the individual.
If someone's so sleepy they can't answer your question, isn't that in itself a big red flag?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've had that.
Where that's my red flag as a doctor. It's like, hello, I'm Dr. Lev. Hello.
100%. I've had people, for example, under the influence of narcotics, like opiates, where they are nodding out during the evaluation and their eyes are closing and their head is going down. And it's very difficult to get that done. But part of being a DRE is having patience and taking the time to.
Are you videotaping this? Because a picture is 1,000 words in these situations.
Every single evaluation is videotaped on my body cam. And if I'm in a station, there's a camera there filming as well. Because again, like you said, a picture is worth 1,000 words. I could write all this on paper, but showing it in court is bulletproof in my opinion.
Yeah. I've seen some of those cameras. I've been one of those physicians asked to review tape to see if, you know, when the DRE couldn't tell about impairment. And I think my favorite ones with someone who's like clearly high on meth and says, oh, no, these are my medications. And he cannot keep still for a second, all over the place. And it's like, oh, no, it's my medicine. And but yeah, even if it is your medicine, you shouldn't be driving like that.
And that's very important point. And I'm glad you brought that up because we see a lot of officers, unfortunately, who don't have DRE training or any kind of advanced training get fooled by that, where somebody says, I'm on this medication, I take this drug, I'm prescribed it, I can't be DUI from it. Absolutely, you can be. And it's still illegal to drive under the influence of it, even if you're prescribed it.
Yeah, that's important. All right. So you were saying that you're doing all these tests, 12 steps, and you're able to detect impairment. You were also mentioning that you could say what type of drugs, which is surprising for me because that's not easy, even as a physician. And most people are on multiple drugs, rarely just one.
Yes. So with the DRE program, we never say the exact drug that the person is impaired by. We say what drug category. And we look at drugs in the DRE program in terms of 7 categories. And we only classify drugs that are impairing in those categories. So a drug like Tylenol or Advil, over-the-counter drugs, those would not fall into the categories because they're not causing the psychophysical impairment that the other drugs would cause.
What are the 7 categories?
So we have CNS depressants, CNS stimulants, dissociative anesthetics, narcotic analgesics, inhalants, cannabis, and hallucinogenic drugs. So every single one of those categories might have several dozen, or in the case of depressants, hundreds of different drugs that fall within that category. And I'm not concerned with whether somebody is, for example, with narcotics, whether they're under the influence of oxycodone or heroin. In the end, those signs and symptoms are going to look very similar. So I'm going to say the impairment is a narcotic analgesic that's causing the impairment. I will never say the exact drug, just the category. Now, for some people, they may, as you said, take lots of different drugs, and I might see indicators consistent with multiple categories. As a DRE, the most categories that I've ever identified impairment from, actually been able to articulate the impairment on a person, is 3 of the 7 categories. Now, a toxicology test ended up coming back with 4 or even 5 categories of those drugs, but I just didn't see the impairment from the other two. And even if I had, it starts to blend together.
Yeah, I couldn't be able to tell that. And I mean, as a physician, I always like guess what people are on, and then I get the drug screen, and sometimes I'm wrong.
That's true for the DRE as well. There are times where we are wrong. As of right now, my toxicology rate, my, for lack of a better term, success rate is 100%. I have not called a drug category of impairment that was not confirmed by toxicology. I have had people with other drugs on board that I didn't identify, but those drugs were not showing the signs and symptoms of impairment. And for most DREs, they're pretty close to that. Most DREs are 90% plus accurate in identifying the drug category that's causing the impairment.
That's impressive.
That's what makes the program valuable.
I don't think that that's as critical. I think it's more critical to know that you're impaired. You know, whatever drug you're on, you are not able to perform a function, the privilege of driving, regardless of whatever drug you're on, whatever category it is. I mean, it's nice and impressive that you're able to categorize that. I don't know that I could do that, but I think we could all 100% of the time tell someone's impaired and you should not be driving.
Absolutely. And thankfully, at least in Illinois and most states, there is no legal requirement to actually call a drug as causing the impairment. You just have to rule out alcohol and medical, and you're left with drugs. But having that DRE evaluation really provides valuable evidence in court for the prosecutor. And in this day and age, judges and juries, as you have probably seen, they have the CSI effect. They want to see the science. They want to see the technological know-how in the evaluation process. They want that opinion in court to hear, well, you're telling me this person was impaired, but what's causing it? They want to hear that. So that's where the DRE comes into play.
Now, the other thing is interesting to hear your protocol about first the breathalyzer, and if it's less than 0.08, but you feel that you're impaired, then you go on the other steps. One of the things that we kind of see that it's missing, we know that people take multiple drugs, not just one. And the fact that if someone has the alcohol positive, presumed positive, they don't evaluate for further drugs. And that's a gap, because if you're 0.05, okay, but you also have a whole bunch of marijuana on board or other drugs, you're impaired because those drugs are additive in nature. So we're really trying to, not successfully, but have law enforcement not stop at the alcohol, but continue in testing for other drugs. So we can show that additive effect. And if you look at the NHTSA data, we have all the alcohol data. We don't have all the other drug data because people stop testing if they know that alcohol is positive.
You're right. And to an extent, that is 100% true. If I provide a breath sample, if I get a breath sample from somebody and they're showing 0.08 or higher, in Illinois, I've met the statutory criteria for DUI, alcohol, and I'm not generally going to test more. Now, if I'm at somewhere between that 0.05 and 0.079 up to 0.08, and they're still showing significant impairment, absolutely, I'm going to continue with the evaluation. I am going to get a blood and urine sample as well, because there is definitely something else there that is adding to that impairment. Most people, unless they're young, inexperienced drinkers, are not showing significant impairment at 0.04, 0.05. 0.08, yes, we've seen significant impairment from, but much lower than that, no, we're not seeing that. So you're right, when we do see that significant impairment, even below 0.08, but just positive for alcohol, we are continuing with the evaluation and doing additional testing.
Yeah, or I'm wondering if it should be for any like serious illness. Like I recently took care of a man who came in for a motor vehicle crash, and he just killed someone while he was impaired. And he was positive for alcohol, but he had other drugs. And I remember telling the officer, like, you know, you need to test for other drugs too, not just the alcohol.
I would agree with that, absolutely, especially in a fatal or serious injury crash. We want to get as much information as we can to show what led to that crash.
All right. So, Ari, let's do a ride along with you. Take us on your typical day. You got your uniform on. You're showing up to work. Like, what do? You have like a briefing, or what happens?
So right now I have the privilege of being the commander of the Sheriff's Marine Unit. So I'm actually more on the water than I am on land right now, which was an entirely new ballgame for me when I got this assignment 3 years ago. I had no boating experience prior to taking command of the unit. And I was basically told, hey, come out here and do the best you can.
Did you know how to drive a boat?
I'd never driven a boat before, never, prior to 3 years ago taking this assignment. And this opened up a whole new world for me because now I was dealing with impairment on the water, which is a whole other, as I said, ball game where there's different field sobriety tests called the seated SFST battery that I'm actually trained to administer and teach others now. And we have to deal with the nuances of boating. But my typical day out here is to come to work sometimes in the morning, sometimes early or late afternoon. I get the deputies set out on their boats, get their assignments out to them, and they go out on patrol. And if there's a free spot on a boat, I will join them. And we go out, we talk to boaters, we stop boats for different conservation and boating violations. We are basically looking for safety related violations at this point. And occasionally, a couple times a week, we will run into impaired boaters, impaired by alcohol and or other drugs. And we'll have to go through an OUI investigation, which is an operating under the influence investigation. We have here in Lake County, Illinois, the very first water accessible cannabis dispensary. It is called the Smokehouse, and there are 35 boat slips outside of it. You can drive your boat right up and purchase recreational cannabis. The law in Illinois states that you cannot smoke on the boat, but I am assuming that that happens quite often because we see it quite often. So we know it is actually occurring. Just like it occurs in vehicles where you're not supposed to do it.
That reminds me of the days when you had drive-in beer and liquor.
Yes, and it's funny because we saw how bad that was, and we didn't really learn a lesson from that.
We just don't
learn got it with cannabis. But that's a typical day for me right now, is going out there on the water with the deputies and enforcing the boating regulations, responding to boat crashes, acting as a visible deterrent to unsafe boating.
Yeah. So Lake County makes sense that you have things on the lake. Beer and boating, that kind of goes together. Are you allowed? Is it a 0.08 rule for operating a boat the same as a car?
It is. 0.08 is the per se legal limit for boating. However, there is no law that forbids you from consuming alcohol while operating the boat. So you can drive around on a boat and see people drinking a beer while they're driving. And it is the last socially acceptable place where you can do that. If you saw someone driving a car, drinking a beer, I would hope that most people would be mortified to see that.
Yeah, that's that. We change that social culture, not acceptable.
Yeah. And we should absolutely change that social culture out on the water. There is no reason that you can't have a sober driver for the boat, just like we have sober drivers for vehicles. You can still enjoy a day on the water as the driver without ingesting alcohol and or drugs. But unfortunately, the culture of boating, at least out in this area, is very much that alcohol and boating go hand in hand. There are quite a few bars and restaurants on the water that serve, some that overserve. And now with our cannabis dispensary here, our hands are full with impaired operators. And we have seen far too many injuries and fatalities out here from impaired boaters that the law should have caught up to that.
I'm wondering if you have the public health data on that to show, like, just yesterday I was speaking in Oregon, and they changed their cannabis edible laws, the potency. They went from 50 milligrams per package to 100 milligrams per package. And they have the public health data showing increased ER visits, increased poison center calls after making that, you know, policy decision. I'm wondering if you have the same thing. You need data to show that, you know, when you opened up these boatside cannabis dispensaries, you know, safety incidences have gone up.
We do. And unfortunately, we are a little behind the times. You go to places like Oregon and Washington, where they were on the forefront of decriminalization, and they've had more time to collect that data and develop it to show that it's bad. We're seeing it anecdotally now. We don't have the hard data to support it like they do at this point, but anecdotally it's bad and it's problematic. And I know that in a few years we'll have that data and hopefully be able to change it. Where the problem comes in is the will from the public, the will from our elected officials to change it. Cannabis decriminalization is very popular in Illinois. And making more restrictions on that is not something that is politically smart, at least right now in this state.
Right. But I don't think even people who want to smoke pot, they don't want impaired drivers.
The problem, though, Dr. Lev, is that a lot of people that ingest cannabis don't see what they're doing as impairment.
That's true. They don't have the perception of being impaired, but the data does.
Yes, but trying to convince the elected officials that the data is correct and the users are wrong, that's where it becomes difficult, because there's a very strong lobby to the contrary. There's a lot of money supporting the opposite opinion as well. And that's where we run into our fights.
All right. Not a new concept. Addiction for profit industries are powerful. That's been that way for tobacco, alcohol, everything else. But I hope you continue to collect that data, and public health is your partner in doing that. All right. Back to your shift. You see someone who you believe is impaired. What do you do?
Well, if we stop their boat, I'm first and foremost going to ask them to come over to my boat. I'm going to have them put a life jacket on. The simple act of putting a life jacket and coming over to our boat to talk to me further, that in itself is a field sobriety test. You would be amazed at how difficult it is for an impaired person to put a life jacket
on. Oh, yeah. I can imagine.
Simply doing the buckles is very difficult. So that gives me some good evidence. Once they get on the boat, it's going to flow in a similar manner to a roadside DUI investigation. I'm going to ask medical-related questions. I'm going to ask about prescription drug use. I'm going to ask about physical problems. And then I'm going to start doing the field sobriety tests. And with the boat, because the ground underneath us is moving, we can't do any tests that require the person to stand or balance. Also, because obviously equilibrium problems if we were to take them to shore. So all of the tests that we're going to administer on the boat are done in the seated position. And they're called the seated SFST battery. And they were developed by NASBLA, which is essentially the water equivalent of NHTSA. And they have been scientifically validated by the exact same people, the Southern California Research Institute, that scientifically validated the standing field sobriety tests. And the data is very similar in regards to the percentages of accuracy showing how they can identify someone at 0.08 or higher. So we'll administer those tests. And based on those tests, we'll decide if that person is impaired. And if they are, place them under arrest at that point. And the boat gets towed, just like a vehicle would get towed, and they get brought to our marine base processing.
What if there's other people on the boat?
9 times out of 10, there are several people on board, sometimes families and children. Last night, for example, I got home late this morning at 2:30 in the morning because we had a very late OUI arrest. It was 4 adults and a 3-year-old infant on board the boat at 2:30. Almost midnight. What is a 3-year-old infant doing on a boat at midnight? I don't know. But the mother was heavily impaired. She was the operator of the boat. And that's a very unique challenge to boating. We have to bring all those people on board our boat, provide them with safe transit back to our base, get them a safe, sober ride to where they're going. In this case, we had to get a car seat for the child. So that was an additional challenge. But that is something we don't face usually on the roadside. Generally, if they're sober, they can walk away. If it's a safe area, they can call a Lyft or an Uber to leave. We can give them a ride somewhere. But on a boat, it's definitely more of a challenge.
Right. In your career, do you have any cases that really stood out?
I do. I have a couple. One in particular relates to DUI drugs. This was about 6 years ago now. Actually, no, it was closer to 8 or 9 because it just become a DRE and finished my training. I arrested a young man about 23, 24 years old for DUI drugs. It was a narcotic analgesic impairment. He was a heroin user. He had heroin needles and other paraphernalia on him. And this kid was in bad straits. I mean, you could tell physically he was wasting away. He was very, very bad in terms of his physical condition. And it was very sad to see someone that young that was in such bad shape. And I arrested him. He was released pending court appearance. The first court date came up and he wasn't in court. His attorney, no attorney appeared on his behalf. And so the state continued it to a couple months later. A couple months go by, court appearance is coming up. I still see on the docket online that he has no attorney of record. So I just out of sheer curiosity, because I follow my cases, I went and followed up with his family. I went to his house. I said, what, you know, is this person coming to court? Is this case going on? And I ended up talking to his father, who told me that about a month after the traffic stop, that this young man had overdosed and died from heroin. And so obviously he was not going to be making it to the court case, but I thought the father's next statement was going to be a blame to me for causing this. But he said that the arrest of his son was one of the best things that I could have done for him, because his son had been stopped by the police prior. He had been let go. He had been given breaks. And he felt that this truly was a turning point for his son. And following the arrest, he actually had stopped using for a brief period of time. He was trying to get help to get to that first court appearance and to be clean and to get on a better path. And because of life circumstances, unfortunately, he went back to using, as many substance abusers will do. And that first time he went back, he overdosed. So that was one of the saddest cases I investigated. I still maintain some contact with the family. A couple times a year, I will talk to them about the case. It was very difficult, because I don't do what I do because I have a hatred or a dislike in my heart for impaired drivers. I do it because I really want to save lives. And I feel in my heart that even though this young man was on this path of no fault of mine, that I didn't do more, couldn't do more to save him. And that hurts.
You know, I've talked to several parents and they'll beg, please, you know, take my child to jail. They'd rather have their kid in jail than dead. And sadly, that's a common scenario of somebody who wanting to, you know, staying off drug for a while, but then, you know, the addiction is a very strong force. And if you go back to using the same amount, then you're going to die, because your body's not used to that. That is very sad and painful. Then you continue doing to what you're doing. And again, it's very nice that the family was thankful. And I've seen that a lot.
And on the flip side, if I can mention one other case, this was directly related to cannabis. We had a crash, a rear end collision on one of our major roadways. A gentleman doing about 75 miles per hour in a 50 mile per hour zone rear ended a family, a mother, a father, and their 1 year old infant. And unfortunately, the infant was exactly where they should have been. They were in a car seat, properly secured, and they did not survive the crash.
Oh, the baby didn't? Oh.
The baby did not survive. And I was called to do a drug influence evaluation on the offending driver, who, of course, did not have any injuries, as generally they don't. And I can recall when I talked to him, I didn't initially tell him that the child had died. And it was only at the end of the evaluation that I told him this. And I will never forget his reaction. And I can think what my own reaction would be, but his was, it was just an accident. I didn't mean to do it. And to me, we said in the beginning about the difference between the word crash and accident. And to me, that best exemplifies why I will never use that term accident, because that was no accident. Accident is something that was entirely unpreventable, couldn't have been foreseen, no one's fault. It was his fault. He was impaired by cannabis. He should not have been behind the wheel of a car. Those parents would still have a child. That child had a future ahead of him. There's no reason that child had to die that night, but for this man choosing to drive impaired. It was not an accident. It was a crash.
Right. And even if you lack the perception, that's when we've done simulation tests of people, volunteers smoking, given a simulation driving test. They don't feel like they're impaired. They don't have the perception, but the test shows that they don't have their stopping time and peripheral vision is at least 4.5 hours. So that's the message we're trying to get out, that if you're going to use marijuana or smoke marijuana, don't get behind the wheel, don't drive yourself, and don't go in a car with somebody else who's driving, just the same as alcohol. And that's just for smoking. Edibles is much longer. So you mentioned that he was driving 75 miles an hour in a slower lane. Most people think the marijuana impaired drivers are like, you know, Cheech and Chong, la, 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 driving slow. But I learned really from Jennifer that the people going 100 miles an hour, these are not slow drivers.
Yes, that is one of the biggest misconceptions, that cannabis slows me down. I'm more aware of what's going on around me. Anecdotally, I can tell you that in the last 3 years, every DUI drug arrest that I have made where cannabis was the impairing drug, the reason I stopped these people was either speeding excessively, driving recklessly, meaning weaving in and out of traffic, driving in the shoulder, or some combination thereof. I have not arrested anybody for driving under the influence of drugs with cannabis who was driving 5 miles an hour in the right lane. It has not happened to me ever.
Right. And I think that that speaks to the potency of marijuana now. It's people who are impaired and have a reaction. It's because it's high potency, lots of amount, and that acts more like a stimulant rather than a depressant.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, all right, fun stuff. What are some of the excuses people give you when you pull them over?
Well, my favorite.
Are there any good ones I should be using?
No, I'll tell you this. Every excuse is really no excuse, because there really isn't. I have had many people tell me that I was the designated driver. I'm the one that was safe to drive. And I've arrested many a designated driver for DUI. If you're going to be a designated driver, do not drink at all. Do not ingest drugs at all. That's the whole point of being the designated driver. Or I'm only driving home. I live just down the street. Or I have had people tell me, I always smoke weed. I drive better high. That's one of the worst ones to hear. You do not drive better high. You don't do anything better high. As you explained, that the tests show absolutely the opposite is true. Those are the main ones that I get. Occasionally people will cry and plead and things like that. And I don't take it lightly. I don't look at a DUI arrest as a very minor thing. I treat them with respect, but you're not getting a pass on that for me. You don't get a pass on DUI. I don't care who you are, what your status in life is, you don't get a pass on DUI.
Right. I guess when I asked you that question, I was thinking about just a speeding ticket, because I've had my share. and I never know what I'm going to work. I need to. What about just plain, not DUI?
Just plain. I did have a gentleman tell me that he was going, had to go to the bathroom very badly. And I said, well, I'll just be a couple minutes. And I came back to the car with his ticket a couple minutes later. And he wasn't kidding. He had to go to the bathroom, and he did. And I could see that it was very plain and obvious in his lap. And I almost for a second felt that maybe that was a better punishment than the ticket. But sorry, man, I already wrote the ticket out.
Is that true that once you wrote the ticket, you can't tear it up?
It depends on department policy. Our department doesn't have that. That is a policy, but this was pretty excessively fast, and he needed to have that ticket.
All right. Police pull you over. What do you recommend for the people who, what's the best policy?
Sure. A couple of things. First and foremost, if the police are trying to pull you over, identify to them that you see what they're trying to do. Make your intentions known. If you're going to pull off to the right, put your turn signal on to let them know you're going to the right, slow your speed, and get to a safe place. Now, if there's no safe place at that point, put your hazards on and drive under the speed limit to get to a gas station or somewhere else where you can safely pull over. Once you do so, roll the window down completely. If it's at night, turn the interior lights of your car on and just keep your hands in plain sight. All we would ask from you is you don't have to admit to me anything. You don't have to admit you were speeding. You don't have to make any kind of excuses to me. Just be respectful. That's all I ask, because I'm going to be respectful and polite to you. Don't make any sudden movements anywhere in the vehicle. If you need to reach for something, a wallet, an insurance card, something of that nature, just tell me what you're going to do before you do it. Now, I'm not saying that I'm an overly jumpy or nervous person to where I'm going to react poorly if you do that, but there are police officers that may, and I don't want something to happen that doesn't need to happen. So just broadcast your intentions ahead of time. And as I said, be polite. There are officers who will tell you that I've already made up my mind whether to write the ticket before I get up to the car. I will say sometimes that's true, depending on the violation, you know, excessive speed, 100 miles an hour, that type of thing, you're probably getting a ticket. But oftentimes, if you are polite and you're apologetic for it, to me, that serves the same purpose as a ticket. I've stopped you. I've identified the behavior. You understand it's wrong, and that's enough. You're probably not going to do it again with a warning. A warning serves the same purpose. But if you're going to treat me poorly, and you're going to be, unkind to me, well, I have a broad range of options there. I have wide discretion. So it's always better to just be polite than not.
Right. Punishments for DUI. That's actually very helpful, Ari. I think that's really good advice for anybody or anything. Punishments. I imagine if you're pulling someone over, giving them a ticket, taking them to jail, they're not happy with you. And I don't know if you're just doing your job. Punishments of what happens is someone else's, right? That's the judge's decision.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
So and I let them know that. I tell them always, this is not personal. You'll have people try to make it personal. Oh, you have to meet a quota. Oh, you're doing this because I'm this, that, or the other. It is absolutely nothing personal. This is a job to me. You can call me names. I'm still going to be polite. I'm still going to be respectful to you. At the end of the day, this is my job. And I don't take anything you say personally, because I know you're probably more upset at the situation than you are at me. And that's just the nature of the beast of being a police officer. But I will do everything I can to make it as quick and as painless as I possibly can for you, because I know you don't want to be there any more than I want you there. So we'll make this go as quick as we can.
Yeah. Sadly, I don't know if you realize that, but my profession deals with that as well. I think people probably curse you out more than they do me, but I think at least once a shift, someone gives me the F-bomb directed at me, and we deal with it the same way. I think we, some physicians aren't used to that, but where I work, that is, if someone didn't curse at me once a day, I'd be like, oh, where am I? I must be at a different location.
I can't think of an original insult or curse word that someone has said in years. I've heard it all, making fun of my bald head, making fun of my stature. I have heard it all. There's nothing you could say that would hurt my feelings. But there's nothing.
Prevention. I think, like me, I think we have that in common as an emergency physician and public safety. We see the worst of the worst, but that makes us the best experts as to how to prevent this. What should we do? I see lots of falls. I'm thinking, okay, elderly falls on Coumadin. We got to do, that's a common thing. That's a prime spot for prevention. I don't want to have these people come in the emergency department. I think you have the same type of perspective. You've seen lots of traffic crashes, and you probably have ideas of prevention, not just from people who are behind the wheel, but also, situations, mechanics. What are you noticing that needs to be done for prevention?
I have noticed that prevention has to start from an early age. We cannot start preaching anti-impaired driving, safe driving, when someone already has a driver's license. It's too late by then. They've already formed preconceived notions. They've already had ideas of how they're going to behave well before that. So we need to start at a young age with children, early teens, et cetera, letting them know about unsafe choices, letting them know the truth about what cannabis actually does to you, letting them know the truth about what alcohol actually does to you, and making it less normalized that it's okay to drive under the influence of those substances. I want it to be socially unacceptable to drive under the influence of cannabis. It took us a long time to get to the point where DUI alcohol was socially unacceptable. If you're arrested for DUI alcohol now, that's a stigma. People look down on that, and rightfully so, because it's a dangerous behavior. But DUI drugs is not looked at the same. We have to get to that point where it is socially unacceptable to drive impaired. And that has to start with education at an early age. I would also add, in addition to the education component, we need an enforcement component. That's a big part of it. We have to have police officers that are trained to recognize the signs of impairment from drugs other than alcohol. I'm not saying make every police officer a DRE. That's absolutely not necessary, and that's too time consuming. But there's other training, such as advanced roadside impaired driving enforcement. It's an A called A-Ride. It's a 2-day class that gives police officers essentially it bridges the gap between the basic SFSTs and the DRE program. It allows them to feel comfortable making a DUI drug arrest, and identifying signs of impairment from drugs other than alcohol. We need police officers, every single police officer, to have that, at least that training to make that arrest. And then to actually go out there and do it. We need to make DUI enforcement a priority. Every agency needs to look at it as a priority, not just agencies where they have a lot of traffic problems, or where they're running call to call, so they say they don't have time to enforce traffic. If you start enforcing traffic laws and you make traffic a priority, you will find that other crimes will go down. Everybody's got to go somewhere in a car. Burglars have to get somewhere in a car. People that are going to commit other crimes use cars. And a lot of those people are impaired while they're doing those crimes. And perhaps if we can pull them off the street before they commit that crime, well, then we're preventing more crime, right? So there's the enforcement aspect. And then we have to follow up with the judicial component of it. We have to explain to our judges, our prosecutors, what impairment from drugs other than alcohol looks like. When I present a DUI drug case in court to a judge or a jury, they have a preconceived notion of what impairment looks like. They're looking for the stereotypical drunk, the person falling down, stumbling, slurring their words. And as you know, Dr. Lev, that's not what some drugs look like. Cannabis, for example, does not look like that. So we really need to educate our prosecutors and especially our judges that that is not what impairment, all impairment looks like. So really, it's that three-pronged approach from early education to enforcement to the judicial aspect of it. But especially the prevention early on, that has to start at an early age. Driver's education programs as well need to talk a lot about impaired driving. They need to have police officers like me in there talking to the students, explaining what this drug does, explaining what the consequences are, but as well as long before that too, and denormalizing, for lack of a better term, impaired driving.
Ari, you are spot on. All three of those aspects, I couldn't have said it better. That's amazing. And I am wondering if you have gone back to schools as Superman and superhero to influence other kids to be police officers when they grow up, like what happened to you?
I hope so. I know I've influenced at least one. I taught a class at CLC, which is the College of Lake County. I taught for a class a number of years ago, not a full class, but one session. And a couple of years after that, we hired a new deputy. And I didn't remember this person, but he told me that I spoke in his class at the College of Lake County. Aww. And that's what sealed his decision to become a police officer. So that was a very proud moment for me that I was able to make that difference. And I hope there are many others. This is an honorable profession. If I can get on my soapbox for a minute, law enforcement is an honorable profession, and we need good people. We need smart people. We need thinking people that are going to want to make a difference and think through the complexities of these situations of how to make that difference. I still love this job as much as I did almost 18 years ago. I never regret doing it. I love every day of it. I couldn't be happier doing what I'm doing. And I hope more people take up that that cause one day.
That's beautiful. Well, it's come full circle. Love that. Ari, I hope we get to do our panel together. It's called the Lifesavers. It'll be in Los Angeles, and it'll be me, you, and Jennifer Cifaldi, and a prosecutor. So we got a judge, a prosecutor, an officer, and a doctor together on a panel. I think that's going to be fun.
That'll be awesome. I'm looking forward to it. I hope we can do it.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.